seeing that the monarch had come to his hermitage, okay, he came to his hermitage, and was bowing before him, the sage greeted him with benediction, okay, and received him with due honor. The sage greeted him with benediction. Hey, hang cool, man. Be cool, brother. And received him with due honor. You know, yeah. Dusted off his chair. Okay. So then, what we did, we went back here, and of course, our habit is to try and look at these things in a, you know, general perspective. We have that mentality. And also, my goodness, is this what we should be really doing? You know, right for now for Krishna, are we caught up in some kind of academic thing, or really is this what we should be reading and should be hearing? How is it, you know, useful for us? So, of course, you know, out of all the world literature, it's, you know, really Srimad Bhagavatam stands at the top in my experience of looking at a lot of it. 1001 Arabian Nights, the Bible, the Quran, Don Quixote, Shakespeare, Sun Wukong from China, you know. It very much stands supreme as the best world classical literature. And so Prabhupada's telling us, out of all of the literature we have, the whole thing, the Bhagavatam is our very means of conquest. And of course, the first canto is informing us in the form of sarga, you know, how preface this whole thing, and how the world's being created, you know, by Mahavishnu, his creation. And then, what is it? I guess next one is Visarga. Then we get the creation then by Brahma somewhere in here. It's happening one after another. You know, and so where are we? Why? What's going on? Who am I? What's happening? How does the world work? Basic questions. Little children ask this question all the time. Yeah. So first off, it's being created by God. You know, he has his general purpose. And then specifically, it's being created by living entities. So we see the living entities from the very beginning, and God are involved with each other. And don't never ever think that God's often like, you know, some creation aspect and has nothing to do with our lives. We're all involved with this. And so Brahma, right away, is put in charge of, you know, of this particular universe. Our Brahma, you know, whoever he is, you know, he becomes the Brahma. So be it. So sarga visarga, and he then is so powerful. He starts to create all these secondary forces. And he creates the Manus, you know. And the Manus are then the people who actually, like, take charge of the actual operation. On the ship, there's the captain, and then there's the officer of the watch. So the captain's the guy in charge. He doesn't really run the ship. He'll be on deck and there when he wants to at certain times and may take specific control. But the officer of the watch is maybe 6 hours, and there's four of them. And they overlap 1 hour before and 1 hour after. They're there 1 hour before their watch takes over, and they just hang around 1 hour, you know, while other guy's taking over or something like that. So there's an overlapping here in the Manus, you know, between the different Manus. So very normal, you know. So we're talking about now about the creation with Lord Varaha and everybody else, and finally we've come to the Manus and their creations. And, of course, they need a little help from Varaha to get Bhumi Loka, you know, fixed up where they can come down and have the proper consciousness to have biological creation. But all of this, we shouldn't forget it, in our own service, is to the point of getting out of Sarga, Visarga, Manu Kata, and coming to the Supreme Summum Bonum. And in the lower left in our picture, we have the Summum Bonum there. this little country boy, you know, with his hand on his chin, looking at the Srimad Bhagavatam and thinking, isn't that nice, you know. I had this image recently of, here's Krishna, a little boy, going down a path in Vrindavan. He turns in the corner, and there's a little girl, you know, Radha. He's maybe like, you know, six, and she's five, and she's crying like anything. And he says, what's wrong, Radha? He says, oh, I lost my kitty, or something like that. Of course, probably the calf in their culture, you know. Oh, my goodness, you know. And that's the whole thing of this intense reciprocations to try and make a better braja, you know, all these kind of things. So that's the summum bonum, if we can kind of fit it into our whole picture and understand it, and not only that, it's reawaken that consciousness. You know. Okay. And then coming down specifically to this chapter, which of course involves this whole story of Manu, and then Maharishi Parikshit says, well, tell me then, okay, this first Manu, tell me about his sons, his daughters, and how they were all had children and so on, like that. So the first one is taken up is Devahuti, but probably both the boys were already married before this, and her older sister, Prasuti, was also married. But he cuts right to Devahuti because he wants to talk about Kapila, you know, the most interesting incarnation that appears. I'm sure the others have directly. Prasuti doesn't. And what's his name? Vasuti Devahuti Akruti. Akruti Devahuti Prasuti. Prasuti also, I don't think, has any direct son who's an incarnation. Exactly. Maybe. Ruchi. And Uttanapada has Dhruva and like that. Pracheta? No. So right away, let's go to Kapila. He's an incarnation. So, okay, so then because of this, we're hearing then the story of how all this happened and how Manu then, you know, was looking for his daughter. He was able to get children after the Varaha incident. And now he's going to find daughter, you know, for his whatever. And so trying to describe her husband. So this chapter has been describing, you know, how Kardamani Muni was doing austerities, who he was, who's he going to be, you know. And then Vishnu appears, so he offers very, very nice prayers, and he says, you know, you're so kind, you take care of everybody, you take care of even people with material desires, you know. You personally do it, you know, and that helps them to become purified. But they're not as intelligent as people who can get free from these things immediately. But I have to confess that I'm in the same category, you know. And so therefore, I'm surrendering to you for my desires. Then Vishnu says, yes, it's very nice of you. I'm very, very ingratiated because of your austerities, you know, your pure devotion to me. They've already arranged a very, very nice daughter with big eyes and, you know, nice smile and very, very good sensitivity towards taking care of the household affairs in a very nice fashion, you know. And she show up, you know. And some nice descriptions there. A third canto, we're already starting to get into a little bit of, again, parental guidance 16, PG 16, before people can read this stuff. Yeah? But it's connected to Krishna now, and these real passions and stuff can be connected. Okay. So then Vishnu leaves, and it says then, in the previous verses to this verse, then after the departure of the Lord, okay, so he started doing his austerities and everything else, and then it says, next, Swayambhu Manu, with his wife, mounted his chariot. So you have two sides in our drama here. I'm telling them, Spanish, telling them about it. In our soap opera, Kardam is doing his austerities. Om, Om Namo Bhagavate, Om Namo Bhagavate. Getting progressively more skinny. And then Swayambhu Manu is on the chariot with his wife, and they're taking their daughter along, and everybody else is married. And heading off, kind of like, I guess, a Mercedes-Benz or something else. What do we got? A Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce, yeah. Bulletproof gold Rolls-Royce with bulletproof windows. And a laser-directed hellfire anti-tank rockets on the side. A few things, you know. Yeah. So they're going off now. Okay, so what happens? They reach the hermitage of the sage. The holy lake Bindusarovar was. It's a very beautiful description. They're coming in a very real situation. Of course, we heard fantastic descriptions of the whole environment, you know, this week. And, you know, this is possible. Okay. In some ways, in the modern world, we're worried about this basic thing. You know, is my roof going to blow off, or my car going to blow up? Are people going to attack me and beat me up in my own town? Am I getting cheated by the, you know, unbelievable in the modern world, but here you have an environment which is so celestial, like Hawaii, maybe, you know. But that's not enough. Even that celestial environment, you know, Swayambhu Manu is showing up with anxiety. Kardamuni has some anxiety, you know. And then it describes they entered that entering that most sacred spot. Swayambhu saw the sage, and of course, fantastic verse describing a big challenge for us to all look spiritual. And right away, people can look at us, somebody with intelligence and and they make some decision. Even the dog, if you're afraid and you're going up to somebody's house, you know all quickly, you're afraid, the dog right away will start to, like, pick up on it, you know. Hey, if this guy doesn't feel like he should be here, then why should I think he should be here, you know? He himself feels out of place. Yeah? So even, it's the bhava that we're presenting, yeah? How we're dressed, how our comportment is, how our taste, our what do you call it, our effulgence is there and stuff. So look in the mirror. What do you look like? You look like somebody who feasted on, onion pizza with strawberry sauce the night before until 2 o'clock in the morning, or what? You know? Yeah. So they saw him as such a great person. And then we come again then today to today's verse, where it says, seeing that the monarch had come to his hermitage and was bowing down before him, the sage greeted him with benediction and received him with due honor. Then Prabhupada says, Emperor Swayambhuvamanu not only approached the cottage of dried leaves possessed by the hermit, Kardama, but also respectfully offered obeisances unto him. Similarly, it was the duty of the hermit to offer blessings to kings who used to approach his hermitage in the jungle. On the right, we found a picture here where I look for hermits, you know, Christian things. And here I think of St. Francis with all the animals and peaceful and living together with no problem and living in his hermitage in the forest. So this is where really, where the sages and everybody else really lived, you know. Maybe we're in the big cities and everything else for Sankirtan purposes, but also partly too because we're attached to all the stimulation and everything else, you know. Yeah. But in many ways, the real place in between being attached and being attached to material life and being attached to Sankirtan is a place where one can cultivate this internal consciousness and purify the heart and become in harmony with God's creation and God's creatures. Yeah. It says dried leaves. Of course, when I think of dried leaves, I think of like maple leaves or something, you know, little things the size of your palm. But of course, maybe in Hawaii, in these tropical climates, you see these big leaves, like banana leaves or, you know, or palm leaves or something. And of course, these, of course, you can make into a cabana, into a cottage, without much problem. You just, you know, just take some sticks, maybe even a piece of a little bit sharper stone, and kind of cut off a few little saplings, maybe 6 feet tall, 8 feet tall. And then you go pour some water on the ground until it gets soft, and then it's going to take a peg and something and beat in a hole. You know, put your stick in there and put some earth around it. And then you just bend them over. And with some fiber from some other tree, you can tie them together, lash them together, and you can make a very, very nice, you know, structure, you know, very quickly, you know. And then you can put these leaves on top. And with almost no economic development, when it's warmer weather, you've got a little place to keep the rain off of you and even to keep your body heat in, you know. So Prabhupada says, do that. Find a place along a nice river, which is very difficult now. Take a few, 4 poles from the forest, he says, build a cottage and sit down and chant Hare Krishna and be happy. And depend upon the Lord to supply your eatables if you engage in chanting Hare Krishna. So the king approached, and it's very interesting too, because to me that it says that it was the duty of the hermit, Kardama, to offer blessings to the kings who used to approach. So many kings were coming. It's a very interesting position here. The king had all this ability, education, everything else, but he was definitely not artificially, you know, feeling great respect and practical necessity of being integrated with these hermits and stuff like that and so on. You know? So very different environment now, you know. Okay, the next verse, gritarhanam asinam samyatam prinayan munahi smaran bhagavad adesham ityaha shlakshnaya gira. Translation, after receiving the sage's attention, the king sat down and was silent. Yeah. Recalling the instructions of the Lord, Kardama then spoke to the king as follows, delighting him with sweet accents. So much etiquette here. It says he gave him proper reception. Maybe he had some, all he had to offer maybe were some, you know, some nice leaves, you know. But maybe then there's some, you can also put some smaller leaves under those. If you're ever like caught in the forest sometime at night, you'll freeze to death. Okay, what you can do instead is just pile up leaves until they're like as high as your head and then crawl right inside of them. That's fine. Keep the bugs off. That'll keep you warm. So anyway, put some leaves on the ground, put a palm leaf over them, and here the king is sitting down. And rather than taking control of the conversation, he's just being quiet, maybe with his hands folded properly, you know, looking at the sage respectfully, and the sage then, even younger than him, young enough to be his son, yeah, like that, and not dressed, maybe dressed in the most simple type of environment, you know, and the kid and the soldiers and stuff are back at some distance, area ministers, you know, but the king is sitting there smiling at him, you know, he waits to be spoken to before he's spoken. It's a nice picture of a Raja, you know, here's one Raja and Rani. A little impression of what it was like, Swayambhuva and Satarupa. Yeah. Nunam Chankra Manang Deva Shatam Sang Rakshanayate Vajaya Chasatang Yastvam Harahe Shaktahi Palani. Wish I spoke Sanskrit. Okay. Translation. The tour you have undertaken, O Lord, is surely intended to protect the virtuous and kill the demons. Yeah. Since you embody the protecting energy of Sri Hari, Paritranaya Sadhanam Vinashchaya Chaduskritam. Very clear concept we're seeing repeated again and again. Yeah. So these are the, we see here then that Kardama is receiving the king, you know. And Prabhupada says that one should be addressed and received according to his or her social position so their mind won't be disturbed. So right away he's receiving him in terms of, okay, I recognize you on tour, you know. Yeah? And I also recognize there's a purpose and ambience behind this whole tour, you know, surely intended to protect the virtuous and kill the demons, yeah. Since you embody the protecting energy of Sri Hari. Okay. Now this is actually a series of verses here. They all go together right up until the end of this chapter. So I'll go ahead and just recite the verses. When necessary, you assume the part of the sun god, the moon god, Agni, the fire god, Indra, the lord of paradise, Vayu, the wind god, the lord of paradise. Is that like having a ticket where you never have to leave Disneyland? You have like, you know, a lifetime pass to the hotel and whatever. Vayu, the wind god. Yama, the god of punishment. Dharma, the god of piety. And Varuna, the god presiding over the waters. All obeisances to you, who are none other than Lord Vishnu. Yeah. So it'd be interesting how Prabhupada's purport goes on that. Yeah. How he is Vishnu. But this is the potency. You know? If like, you know, Officer O'Reilly is walking down through the Bronx on a warm, you know, let's say a Wednesday night, you know, and suddenly a futuristic orb descends from the sky and Martians with machine guns or whatever, ray guns start popping out, you know. Officer Riley can just flip on his walkie-talkie and be to his patrol captain in a moment, dispatch, describe the scene to make sure he's not drinking. And then they flip it to the National Guard or whatever, you know, state police, okay. State police flip it to the National Guard or the governor. Governor flips it to the president. He flicks it to the commander in chief, and sure enough, there's an F-116 Hellcat, whatever they are, Tomcat super fighters coming down, and a whole war battle in the And the officer O'Reilly says, a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, you know, and one more on that. And soldiers descending from the sky on bungee cords. So he has the full Shakti, you know, of the United Nations, even. Everything, even Putin kicks in their unknown secret weapons and stuff to fight the evil Martians. You know. So this is, you know, the fact that a real king, austerities and everything else, he has all this potency there. And see, whenever you've done this job, and maybe several of us have been temple president or something, or when you've been a mother, anyway, when you actually take up the position, you see you're getting, the thoughts are coming into your head, which didn't come into your head before, and you're having abilities and stuff, which if you're attentive, you can see, yeah, you know, I'm getting, you know, potency to do this job. And when I don't have this job, it's finished. My kids are growing up now, they're going away, they're getting married, everything else, okay. Then I have a granny potency, grandmother potency, you know, grandfather potency. So it's a fact. He's giving very, very nice glorification, clarification. So Swayambhu Vimanu understands that he's understood and even reminded, who am I? Yeah. If you did not mount your victorious jeweled chariot, whose mere presence threatens culprits, there's a car, eh? It's a police car, no? When it pulls through the rough neighborhood, then right away, you know, things armed, a couple cops in there with guns and authority, it threatens the culprits. If you did not produce fierce sounds by the twanging of your bow, okay? If you did not roam about the world like the brilliant sun, leading a huge army whose trampling feet cause the globe of the earth to tremble, then all moral laws governing the varnas and the ashramas created by the Lord himself would be broken by rogues and rascals. Wow, see, Kartam is really getting into like a real drama. Probably Swayambhu Vimanu is, you know, feeling really good. Yeah, okay, this is my job, you know. Yeah. But what is in the modern world? You're twanging your bow, I guess. You know, every now and again, shooting off some blanks, you know, you go through the, again, Officer O'Reilly and the patrol car comes through and, you know, maybe it gives a couple beeps on there, loud the horn there, you know, boop, boop, you know, what are you doing? You know, don't, you know, nobody want to do this, do that. You know, some kind of loud explosions here and there. And leading a huge army, you know. So if you look at the Dharma Shastras, we're describing this. We've read that it's very violent, you know, cut out their tongue, chop off this, you know, so many things, you know. But the descriptions are that these were like the public notifications you put on the wall. Anybody who spits here, this will happen. You have to lick it up or something, you know. And because they understood that it's very, very rare, actually, that, you know, the king actually has to engage in violence. The Art of War is a famous Chinese classic, which was still studied in military schools. He says that actually actual war is a sign, physical violence is a sign of incompetence of the general. You know, the general should win the war with never having to engage in a single battle. He just shows his enemy again and again, that if, you know, I'm showing you here, I'm showing you there, I'm showing you here, I'm showing you there, I'm cutting you off from your resources. And finally the enemy realizes, you know, that I'm going to get whomped. There's just no question about it. And so then he, you know, rather than as a cornered rat, he might fight. But then the king comes and says, look, you know, I understand this and that, so let's have some peace terms here and this and that, and the guy surrenders. Okay, you know. So it's necessary to have an army which tramples the earth. It's necessary to make loud noises and show your weapons and so on. You know? Okay, maybe I mentioned this, that they were looking at this at the current Chinese diplomacy. And the Chinese have blew up one of their own satellites. with one of their missiles. This is very significant because so much of the military, United States military might is dependent upon satellite communication. And here the Chinese showed up. We can blow up our satellites. Yeah. And you might say, we can also blow up your satellites. Yeah. Well, of course, our presence globally is dependent upon our aircraft carriers. I mentioned this before. If you look up aircraft carriers on the Wikipedia, you'll find something like maybe like 35 aircraft carriers in the whole world. And I think very few countries, maybe four countries, have more than one. And two of those countries do. The second one is just like a mothball thing from World War II or something where it kind of sits there and never goes out once a year. And the rest of them are mostly like vertical takeoff things. You know, fighter planes and whatevers that can take off vertically and haven't got full long runways, you know. But the U.S. then has something like 14 out of the 35 belong to the U.S. And every single one of those is a supercarrier with full long, you know, runway, you know, crew of maybe 2,000 people divided into this and that and stuff. And each one capable of destroying the earth five times over or something, you know. But those are all over the place. They're off the coast of Formosa. They're in the Mediterranean. They're, you know, off the coast of Panama. So the might of our Emperor Trump his arms extend everywhere. And of course, they're not alone. They have maybe a couple cruisers with them, and maybe five or six battleships, and destroyers protect them. So then, not recently, I guess not too long ago, all of a sudden they're off, they're on patrol with all their armaments, extended all their sensors, everything else, and suddenly, maybe like this, you know, 1 mile in front of them, a Chinese submarine just comes right up, like that, maybe, you know, and they didn't have the slightest idea this thing was there. It stayed there for maybe like about 4 or 5 minutes, didn't say anything, didn't have to say anything, and went down, you know, battle stations. So again, you know, we can destroy your satellites. We can destroy your aircraft carriers. Yeah, on and on like this. So this is it. He's showing his might. It's necessary. And then the common people, they understand. Oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. They need a show, a drama. You know, the king has to be a very dramatic figure, like that. You know, yeah. Coming on here, 55. If you gave up all thoughts of the world situation, unrighteousness would flourish. For men who hanker only after money would be opposed, unopposed. Such miscreants would attack, and the world would perish. Those miscreants would attack, and the world would perish. And finishing the chapter, in spite of all of this, okay, I ask you, O valiant king, the purpose for which you have come here. Whatever it may be, we shall carry it out without reservation. So he already knows why he's come. And what he's saying, you know, is that, I'll marry your beautiful doe-eyed daughter with a little snappy figure and pretty clothes and nice smelling, you know, hair without reservation. I'll do the austerity, you know. So it's interesting that almost always, I guess, in life, people are asking questions and answers, and people know what's going on behind. At least we're not on a gross level, you know. At least in the passionate level, you're starting to have some hint about what's happening. And a Brahmana, he knows this will happen, that will happen. You know, he can see the future in terms of people's character and stuff. And if he's not an impersonalist, he's full of personal realizations about, you know, character and activities. You know, Chandika Pandit. Yeah, so he's asking him, you know, you're doing all these things, you're protecting the world. Well, why have you come here to my ashram? And that's how the chapter finishes, like that. So it's created a very nice circumstance and the spirit of somebody very. Now we can relate. Is this my story? Am I Devahuti? Am I Satarupa? Am I Swayambhuva Manu? Am I, you know, what's his name? Kardama. You know, am I a miscreant? Okay, do I want the king to run around and keeping my mind under control? My miscreant mind. Thank you, Prabhupada, for chastising my miscreant mind. Oh, and keeping me from falling into identification with it. You know? So many stories, picking out our stories in the Bhagavatam, meditating, contemplating on it, become familiar with it. Go through Bhakti Bhai Bhava, Bhakti Vedanta, you know, in our community. And see, go overview of the whole thing, you know, seeing what's going on. And then going back and taking up specific workshops in certain areas which interest us and our community. Developing a whole global network of people involved in appreciating and studying Srimad Bhagavatam. And then getting free from our attachments. Okay. Purport. It appears from many Vedic literatures, especially histories, like Srimad Bhagavatam, the other Puranas, and the other Puranas, that the pious kings of old used to tour their kingdoms in order to give protection to the pious citizens and to chastise or kill the impious. Okay, that's why they were touring. Sometimes they used to kill animals in the forest to practice the killing art, because without such practice, they would not be able to kill the undesirable elements. It says the killing art. I guess to be killed by a king was quite an artistic. You form part of a drama, you know. And when you died, you died. Wow, what a way to go. Not sitting there howling on the ground for 15 minutes or some weird, disgusting thing, but you die with great, you know, great dignity. Okay. Kshatriyas are allowed to commit violence in that way because violence for a good purpose is a part of their duty. Here, two terms are clearly mentioned. Vadhaya, for the purpose of killing, and asatam, those who are, I guess, not sat, those who are undesirable. Yeah. On our picture, we have on the right, the cows who are desirable, friendly fellows, and they're restrained just by a little metal fence, which they can break if they're really afraid. And above, we have a whole little pack of wolves there and stuff. look at them close. The middle guy's got no particular good qualities, yeah. And they're going out to try and kill, you know. And to some degree, maybe they aren't undesirable elements. We keep them under control, but then they have their place in the society and the structure too, and okay, and their job to do, you know. But sometimes they get out of hand, so they become undesirable elements when they're not dealing with people properly. They become like aggressive towards people, you know. Yeah. The protecting energy of the king is supposed to be the energy of the Supreme Lord. Bhagavad Gita 4.8, Lord says, Pariktaranaya sadunam vinashaya chaduskritam. The Lord descends to give protection to the pious. Yeah? Yes? And to kill the demons. Therefore, the potency to give protection to the pious and kill the demons or undesirables is directly an energy of the Supreme Lord. And the king or the chief executive of the state, yeah, is supposed to possess that energy. Yeah. In this age, it is very difficult to find such a head of state who is expert in killing the undesirables. Modern heads of state sit very nicely in their palaces and try without reason to kill innocent persons. Yeah. So on the right we found a picture of soldiers with their great iron monster, probably like World War II, huh? I think it's a rear view. The iron monster, you know, going around, you know, killing innocent people. Yeah. So I said that the thought that occurred to me, then this last phrase occurred to me, killing innocent people, because I'd heard some things about this. So I went ahead then and was looking up, and my impression had been that, yeah, what probably said is that, you know, in the modern time they kill more innocent people than soldiers. But then I went to the great source of, and try without reason to kill innocent persons. Okay. So I went here and I looked at the Wikipedia, has a section called Civilian Casualty Ratio. Starting in the 1980s, it was often claimed that 90% of the victims of modern wars were civilians, and they give four citations. Now, of course, you may want to look up those citations, because sometimes, you know, the things they're presenting aren't all that accurate, you know. Britannica, on the other hand, is done by experts. They're not done by anybody. Anybody can edit the Wikipedia, so you really got to be careful about the thing. But they asked the director of the Britannica, I heard, what he thought about the Wikipedia. And he laughed and said, I use it. He said, Wikipedia is like a chisel, and the Britannica is like a drill. Okay. So Wikipedia can give you information, like talking to intelligent people in a crowd, and maybe a couple of them you don't trust, but by the rest you trust, and then you can look up references. So anyway, here they're saying this is a very common claim starting in the 80s. And the claim was repeated on Wikipedia's Do You Know on 14th December 2010. So it sounds like a nice person. He's giving exact citations. And it has been repeated in academic publications as recently as 2014. These claims, though or widely believed, are not supported by detailed examination of the evidence, particularly that relating to wars, such as those in former Yugoslavia and Afghanistan, that are central to their claims. Some of the citations can be traced back to a 1991, so some of the citations. Monograph from Uppsala University, which includes refugees and internally displaced persons as casualties. So his point, of course, is they aren't being killed or something like that. They didn't die. They just were being moved around. Other authors cite Ruth Leger Shivards, 1991 monograph, in which the author states, quote, in the decade of the 1980s, the proportion of civilian deaths has jumped to 74% of the total. And in 1990, the appears to have been close to 90%, end quote. The most comprehensive examination of civilian deaths, this Wikipedia guy goes on, and you can look on the talk page and see there may be some notation there, you know, discussion page about who's putting this stuff up and what they're doing. The most comprehensive examination of civilian deaths throughout history is by William Eckhardt. And he gives a citation in which Eckhardt states, on the average, half of the deaths caused by war happen to civilians. On the average, half of the deaths caused by war happen to civilians, only some of whom were killed by famine associated with war. The civilian percentage share of war-related deaths remains about 50% from century to century. So the rest of the article, they're quoting different wars and citations. And the way they're presenting it from his book is that, yes, some civilians were being blown to pieces by weapons as collateral damage. Sometimes, they were being directly focused on. For example, you may know about when Japan invaded China, there was a very, very famous Nanking massacre in which they just brought people out of their houses and just killed them, children, women, just killed them. I guess over the night, whatever, it's incredible how they could have done it, but I don't know what it was. Maybe 100,000 people were killed in one night. You can imagine what that was like. And then there's also Genghis Khan, who was famous in genocide and extermination when he would go through cities and stuff like that, even if he would surrender. But the way they're presenting is that most of the citizens died from being displaced in their houses with no water, epidemics of cholera and all these kind of things. So most of the civilian deaths were actually from the results of the war and not directly being targeted. So this is one presentation about what the governments are doing. Another one here I looked up was in the Wikipedia, and it was a quotation on some university site. It says, civilian fatalities in wartime climbed from 5% at the turn of the century to 15% during World War I to 65% by the end of World War II, to more than 90% by the wars of the 1990s. So some difference of opinion there. Of course, Prabhupada's not saying what percentage, but he's talking about that they are killing innocent citizens unnecessarily, like that and so on. So it's an investigation. And our experiences, when we investigate Prabhupada's words and look at that in proportion and so on, we find that this is the kind of thing that's going on. And so that we're not talking about, we're not talking about the kind of kings and kshatriyas that Swami Bhuvamanu portrayed. It's an ideal for us, an ideal we should come to. It's an ideal we should come to in the administration of our own communities. Because, like that. Okay. So that's the point, is that the killing of citizens, how many citizens are being killed, whether they're being targeted by the government. In some cases, yes. And, of course, the nuclear weapons are not targeted towards military sites to a large degree. They're directly targeted towards civilian populations. The chief executive of the state is supposed to possess such energy, and Prabhupada says. And here we see, and we talked about this, how he had this power, and we can see that in the picture, of course, in Maharaj Pariksha, right away with a really wicked-looking sword, empowered, you know, to do this kind of thing. And so we should expect this. We should expect this of our leaders, that they have this potency, you know, to be able to protect the citizens properly and to, what do you call it, annihilate the miscreants, you know. And, of course, in our Brahminical community, you know, we go on here, okay, because without such practice, they would not be able to kill, Prabhupada says. So the Kshatriyas, they have to go to the extent of actually killing something, somebody. And we talked about that, of wolves. I remember the story Shubhdamana Marsh told us that when he was a boy in Manipur, maybe like, 1950 or something, you know, like that, he remembers that, and of course, very simple there at that time, very traditional, there was a tigress, and she was had moved into one swamp area near one of the towns. And she first became apparent when two men were going out in the morning. They couldn't find one calf or something, some cow. And they were going out, and suddenly the tigress just jumped out and just grabbed one of them and just carried him right off, snapped his back, and went out right off with him. And the other guy was standing there just like with, you know, death personified. It just personally come right past him, you know, and his friend was gone. So anyway, she kept coming out every now and again and causing havoc and, you know, killing the wrong kind of people. So the king came, and he came with his soldiers, everything else, and they built a stockade around where identify where she was. Then they set fire to it, so she had to come out. And when she came out, he then challenged her, but very personal extent. There were two big, powerful horses, fully armored, on both sides of the escape, and the king was right in the middle on foot, something like that. And then so the horses were there to force her to go towards the middle. And he was on foot with a proper spear, a proper shield. So you whack the shield right up. Maybe he's got a big sticky part on it. And so she gets caught on the shield, goes for the shield. Her mouth's open, and you have to go right down the throat and hit the heart like that. And you haven't got a lot of chances, you know. Yeah. So if she kills and gets away, okay, you know. But after you kill her in this fair fight, okay, it's a great honor. It's a great distinction. It's a very royal beast, you know, royal person, usually with royal character. But they've gone wrong. They've gone bad. But still, she's a tigress. Still, she's a tigress. You know? So you have to kill her in the proper way. So then the body is taken back, and then whoever is about to retire from active Kshatriya life, he's given the honor to break the backbone with a stroke from his fist. Okay, Kshatriya. Oh, wham. And then there's, a royal cremation, and maybe some of the flesh is there afterwards, and we can have, like, tiger meat, like that. The guy to the king is going to eat tiger meat. So very, very personal, up-close world. Yeah. They had to practice this. I got my black belt in karate, but for me it's more like a theory, you know. I was doing it more like a Brahmin. So Charu hired this guy as a door guard at the Sunday feast, because he had all these weird people, you know, coming in off the Telegraph Avenue. And I'm talking to the guy, and I knew everything he knew in terms of, like, you know, the moves and stuff. But the thing was, he was a Kshatriya. He was working out every week, maybe three times a week. He was especially just, like, tolerating pain and stuff, so he'd be used to it, so he knew what it was. It wouldn't distract him when he got in a real fight, you know. So you got to do it. You got to work out. It can't be just a part of your theory. You got to be immersed in the flow, your bhava. It's the same way a Brahmin who's supposed to fight with words and concepts, he has to know his concepts. He has to know his words. He has to be practicing that. He has to be arguing. He has to be reviewing the words, whatever his particular task is, like that, and so on, you know. And so without that practice, and if we have our community, we have our temples, we have our communities, the same way, the martially spirited Brahmins, they're Brahmins, but they're martially spirited. They like to fight. They like don't want to, you know, be defeated. Even if they win the discussion by kind of like logical tricks rather than real, you know, real intellectual mental tricks, they'll be more inclined that way. Okay. So some Brahmins are like that. They want to win arguments, even if it's just about winning by tricks rather than really winning by good purpose and logical, you know, depth. Okay, but we need some people like that. That's the whole point. The Kshatriyas, only go into battle Yeah, when things have gotten beyond the point of argument and stuff. I think I have one more quote from that. Yeah. Prabhupada says, by his example, Lord Parasaram established that the killing art, although sometimes necessary, is not good. Okay? I always remember this one, 82. Sometimes it's necessary, but it's not good. I always remember that. You know, violence, I put it as violence. Violence is never good, but it's sometimes necessary to defend the weak against the strong when good arguments fail. So at a certain point, it's just that people are being harassed. It's not proper. It should not be done. Can't permit this. We've tried our best to talk these people out of it. Okay, so then this, the Kshatriyas, he says, step back, pastor. This is a job for me. Okay. Yeah. And so they know what to do. They know how to apply violence, you know, properly, you know, pained compliance and get the situation under control. And if it's empowered by Krishna afterwards, everybody, even the thieves and the robbers and the improper guys, they feel, yeah, that was okay. You know, that was, you did a good job. You did your job properly. Okay, I accept you. Yeah. So it's kind of a little perspective on it. And looking at all this and getting the king in the proper perspective, it's interesting because maybe he's even a little like tongue-in-cheek because he's talked all about these things that kings has to do. But a king also has to find a good guy, handsome-looking guy for his daughter also. So maybe there's a little bit of like tongue-in-cheek drama here describing all this stuff. He said, but why have you come here like that? So anyway, I want to thank everybody. Hare Krishna. That's our presentation. And we have 3 minutes, I guess, for complaints.
Just a moment, Maharaj. I don't know what's going on.
Hare Krishna.
You know, before I forget to let everybody know, Maharaj is going traveling again. So this is the last time we're going to hear a class for 2 months. Is that correct?
Oh, no. I just until the 12th. I get back on the 12th.
Oh, it's a short stint. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to Madrid. Yeah, Madrid. I have to go to Spain. I have to tour my kingdom. You know, when I went to Russia, I was so careful not to get any initiate anybody. I mean, people were asking me, hear your class, whatever, the first time. Because pretty much you feel obligated once you have disciples there, you know, however you're classifying them, you feel obligated to go back. And so I couldn't stop on the way to India, so now I have to take this separate trip. And then Krishna arranged that the ticket during that time period was $300 less than other times. I was suspicious. I looked it up, and it's right during Ram Navami. So there, and I'm getting power to go there during a festival, during my job. You know, so we'll go. We'll go from April Fool's Day until January, to April 12th. We'll be gone. Then after that, we're here all the time until June 1st. Then we go West Coast.
Okay.
And we're actually looking to stop over in Hawaii in the fall, you know, on the way to India. You know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Fabulous.
Yeah, for us. Everybody else can take it. Okay. Can go to Midway for the weekend.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. This is Balabhak.
Hi, mate. Hare Krishna. How's the potatoes? How's the potatoes?
Well, we'll find out today. It's Ekadashi.
Okay.
Maharaj, you give a lot of stress to Kshatriyas. They have to be violent. They have to learn the art of killing. In my reading of the Mahabharata, there were instances where Arjuna, even after Krishna spoke to the Gita, he was failing to do his duty as a Kshatriya on a number of instances. For example, he was feeling too soft-hearted to want to fight with Bhishma Dev, and when it came time to fight with Karna, with Radheya, he didn't want to fight unfairly. And yet, throughout all this time, Krishna is trying to like incite his anger to where he will do his job. You know, listen, you got to fight, you got to do it. and his translate really drive Arjuna to bring out that anger so he can do it. So it seems quite obvious that, first of all, the kshatriya cannot do his job unless he feels angry enough to do his job and protect people when the time comes for punishment. And it seems also that, I'm just wondering, are there instances in Vedic history where a king wouldn't be angry enough to do his job when he should have?
I can't, you know, right away say that. Think of it, maybe somebody can. But I'm pretty sure in the Bhagavatam, you know, we'll find, you know, examples of, you know, people, you know, failing to do it. You know, like I say, it's tough, you know. Same way too, it's tough for a Brahmin sometimes. He's got to be completely honest. And he knows this is going to cause problems for people, but that's his job. Okay, you know, yeah. So it's tough, you know. And then, of course, there are other considerations, but sometimes, you can say, it's just hard to do the duty. We're attached this way and that way. And, you know. He had to, like, kill his grandfather, you know? Yeah.
And it just seems that unless a kshatriya allows himself to get angry, he's not going to be able to do his duty.
The Upadeshamrita says that one cannot fight without becoming angry. So you see that. When you see that, what happens is before the battle, they'll exchange insults, you know? Right? Yeah. Even them, you know, ordinary guy, they're kind of decent people, and they'll sit there, you know, you pig, you boar, you pig, you dog, you know, rah, you pig, dog, you know. Whatever. Yeah, that's part of the whole. You know, the whole. I mean, you got to be expert at that too. That's part of the whole thing. Is you said to this, you're really expert at, like, you know, yeah, bad mouthing each other. You know. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, Maharaj, you know, you made a brief reference to contemporary politics with Trump. And this is entirely related to the class today, but you know, there are so many groups of people, so many demographic areas of people who just really dislike this man. And essentially, women dislike him, you know, poor people dislike him. Ethnic groups dislike him. Everybody is hating this guy, but despite of the fact that, you know, they, in spite of all, he won, even in spite of all that hatred. And there's a lot of concern that things are going to go very, very swiftly from the frying pan into the fire under his administration, if he is allowed to act on some of his promises. So my question is, with all these different groups, you know, expressing concern, is there any concern on the part of ISKCON as a missionary movement?
I mean, I'm sure that the GBC would never issue a direct statement at this point. I mean, they're political. The GBC is a political body. You just need. You know, they might make a general statement about things, you know, which is what they should do and stuff, you know. But then, because it gets down, it's the whole thing. When you get to the kshatriya level, it's harder to. For example, I know one devotee who's two devotees who like Trump, talk about him. So I'm a Brahmin, I'm detached, you know. So I'm listening, and this guy told me that Trump was a teetotaler. Never drinks alcohol, you know. So I kind of looked it up, and apparently it's true. He's even saved people who are famous people who are alcoholics and stuff. Yeah. So you start getting into it. It's just like this political level. It's very pragmatic, and you want to do the right thing today. You know, what's the situation right now? And in the broad picture, we'll leave that to the Brahmins. You know, they will tell. Was it okay? What's the broad? So it's a broad general principle. You know, we talk about it, you know, abortion, these things and that, things and so on. And then specifically right now, I think personally, we have sufficient potency in terms of this gun. Huh? What?
Sorry, that's my wife talking
okay.
to me at the same time.
Okay. Okay. I think right now we have sufficient potency in ISKCON that the next election we can run a candidate with our direct members, our congregations, our friends, and the same people who would like our perspective. And I don't think we'd win, but I think we would show something. Maybe 15% of the people would vote for us. Maybe who knows? But I think we come to that point now where we can have a. But of course, the ISKCON wouldn't be involved in it as a church. We just, and that's couldn't be because he's starting to get down to the specific details like that. So that's what I would say. Right. In general, as a general principle, okay, we're in favor of the guy as a teetotaler. Okay, we're in favor of him. You know, other things you've got to go through and look at specifically and talk about policies and that kind of stuff. You know, yeah, yeah.
I remember back in 97, it's the only time I was in India, my wife and I, and Ravindra Swarup, I believe it was, he gave a class in Mayapur one time, and someone asked a question. I didn't hear the question correctly, but I'd listened to the answer very nicely. And as part of his answer, he said, I actually asked Prabhupada the same question myself.
Oh,
the question was, it's in reference to a prayer written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where he prays, when will the day come when the High Court judges will wear tilak? Things like that. And so the question asked to Prabhupada was, does that mean that ISKCON will be involved in politics? And Prabhupada said yes, according to his testimony. He said Prabhupada said yes, ISKCON will be very much involved in politics. But he didn't specifically say that the Brahmanas would be in political
race or the way ISKCON is set up in America now, we're all incorporated as churches, and in general, yeah, as a general principle. He also said he probably said yes, you'll have armies. He said we'll have armies, all these things under our control. And Ravindra Swarup said that he was thinking, my gosh, in the past, you know, this whole thing has been that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. So what's going to keep ISKCON from becoming corrupted? So he asked Prabhupada that question, and Prabhupada said, thought for a while, and he said, if you just follow the four principles strictly, and chant 16 nice rounds a day, you won't become corrupted. Then Ravindra Swarup said he was still worried. He said, is that enough, Prabhupada? And Prabhupada very seriously said, yes, that is enough. You know,
wow.
So there's the standard. You know, we don't go beyond a certain limit. Maybe somebody else has a comment or question too. I don't know.
I was thinking of Arjun when he was thinking of the casualties of war, of the Varna Samskars, all the women who wouldn't have husbands. Is that also like casualties of the war? And
I think what they mean by casualties is death. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Sometimes there's things worse than death. You know, yeah.
Exactly. You know, we have a more broad. They talk about it too in terms of like maiming and this kind of stuff. But it's
and
yeah.
Draupadi.
Yeah, yeah.
That the real person that gets killed is the mother, not the when Asatama they're talking about killing Asatama. She also pointed out that the mother is the one who gets the pain, not the him. He's already dead.
So, wow. Yeah.
I don't know. It's just that it's
much more sophisticated civilization.
Yeah, and the Varna Samskars, and then it says that the forefathers, they're going to be in hell because there won't be anybody to offer them the Shraddha ceremony. Because what's that verse? It says, for those who destroy family traditions, they always dwell in hell, and I thought that was talking about the forefathers, since there'd be no Shraddha ceremony, so there wouldn't be any way to get them out. So that's
they're all much more sophisticated view of the. There's actually one university. I'm looking this up. One university. University has a site called The Cost of War, you know, and they start to get into some of these things a little bit broader than just the number of deaths and so on. After World War II, England was just financially just annihilated after World War II, you know, and they were suffering so much, you know, there and everything else, you know, and they were the winners.
But I was thinking, if the human form of life is meant for self-realization, and it's not used for that purpose, I mean, and if you miss that chance, when's the next chance you're going to get? And if that's another aspect of the casualties, that if the society breaks down, how long it takes to get a society going, and with that breaks down, then all the civilians, they don't get a chance to hear and purify themselves in their human form of life, which it's not easy to get. That who knows the next chance they'll get at? That's a long time they have to suffer, not just one death.
Wow. But some people want it, so Krishna creates Kali Yuga. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Whew. Amazing. It's such a big perspective that we get, you know. I mean, Prabhupada says that my disciples, even though they come from Malachyam in the background, after they're following the process properly, he said they're in a position to dictate to high-class Brahmins. You know, you get such, you know, education, such purification, you know, by this process. And you also, you know your limits too, huh? You know, when, you know, I can talk about this, but this guy is a high-class Brahmin and stuff, you know. Never touched alcohol in his life, never even had a joke with his wife, you know, in terms of, like, you know, sexual relationships. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Wow. So tomorrow, next few verses here, right, talking about glorifying the same topic, you know, of the Kshatriya duty, and I guess maybe Kardamani, maybe they both know why he's there, but it's a little tongue-in-cheek and stuff, you know. They go, why are you here? Can I look for cockroaches in my ashram? You know, spiders? Yeah. Okay, well, thank you all very much. It's been such a nice association. Every Thursday for us, a Brahminical day in Ekadasi, like that. Maybe we'll make a...
Thank you very much, Maharaj.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Thank you very, very much. Hey, I really enjoyed the class. Look forward to seeing you in Boise soon.
Okay, I'll come with my army. My army and my...
We'll feed them all.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
See you in Hawaii. Meow.